episode, we take a look at something that is often not talked about, and that is the enslavement of before 1619. When you hear the show, for those of you that have been listening for a while, we make intro clips, and of course we've been doing these pre-record episodes towards the end of the year. I made an intro clip for the show because of the way the setup is now. I totally sent myself the wrong file, so I can either have been used the intro. But if you want to see the intro, go to youtube.com/thisisrevolutionpodcast and you can see the intro to the show. We'll be up. Get you guys ready. Also, the after-hours segment of this was informative and freaking hilarious. You probably laughed for the last 30 minutes. Chat was on fire. We also have the audio version. Something we try to touch on a little bit on the main show that you're going to hear right now, which is Native Americans owning slaves. Oftentimes, slavery is viewed as kind of just the savagery of Europeans, or settlers, and political economy is going to be taken into consideration. Enslavement of Native Americans and even Native Americans owning slaves is a more complex narrative. We touch on certain parts of it. Of course, indigenous people are not a monolith. Every region, every tribe is very different, has a very different history. We cannot touch on every single tribe and their trials and tribulations. We're talking about a specific time in history that, again, is often overlooked. And in doing the research for the show, it was fascinating to find out how far the Native American slave trade even made its way to Africa. That noise means it's time for me.
Shut up.
Here is Professor Keith Clymer, Professor of Historian. Professor of Historian Haley McGrin. The enslavement of Native Americans. I am.
Good evening, everyone. I am your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution podcast. If you are new to the show, please hit the like and subscribe button. Don't forget to hit the bell so you are notified anytime and every time we go live, as in the new year, we are adding more programming to the channel, video essays from various members of the group, to just brand new shows. With that being said, because there's a lot we have to cover today, this is going to be a very spicy topic, I think. Let me bring in my homie, my co-host, my dog. He is the man that brought the Mau Mau to Newsweek, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
It is very interesting. You have to admit that you get to write for Newsweek.
I mean, I guess.
Negro.
I mean, yeah.
You know as well as I know that we are always shocked whenever it's like, damn, they're publishing Pascal. That's dope.
I think it's an excellent opportunity to expand the political Overton window.
Oh, so very well put. That's what we're doing. We're expanding political Overton window. Are you ready for today's show, Pascal?
Absolutely.
Brianna apparently said Pascal was one of her most popular guests on her Catherine Liu clip.
What?
Brianna Joy. That's the Brianna they're talking about.
Who said that? Where are you getting
Brianna Joy Gray said it. Someone said it in the chat. I have the chat on the side of my screen, and I wanted to read that to you just you know.
Am I supposed to not see the chat? Because I can't see it.
You're banned from seeing the chat.
Is that what happened?
No, if I had that power, I would totally ban you like years ago from seeing the chat. Because you get so mad at the chat. You make Pascal mad. Want me to highlight that message for you so you can see it?
I guess, yeah. One was probably on her Catherine Liu clip today. Oh, okay. I was watching
Bernie Worrell, keyboard legend and Parliament Funkadelic member, Bernie Worrell, said Brianna. I don't know if that's the same Bernie Worrell. I think that Bernie Worrell has passed away. Maybe this is his ghost. I've watched the Catherine Liu, but it was actually pretty good. I did watch it.
I like Catherine Liu a lot, as a matter of fact. She was a great guest.
Yes.
And, I haven't watched that whole episode. I watched a brief clip and it looked interesting, but I did not know that they mentioned me on the episode. Shout out to both of them.
Look at that. Well, you know, Catherine was supposed to come down here and be one of the guests for Terrace Talks.
You mentioned that.
But she caught the corona. And also we were supposed to have some help on today's show with another good friend of show who has done great scholarship in Native American history, Professor John Graham at the Missouri State University. And he also came down and got sick. We had another pre-record show we were supposed to do. That guest came down with it. So I'm not going to lie, I'm a little shook.
That happened on January 1st with Dr. Celestine Joseph.
The January 1st Haitian History Show. Right. I actually mentioned that on the audio only. There were supposed to be
two guests.
Another person. I didn't see who it was.
Yeah, Dr. Liu, and he came down with the COVID. He couldn't make it.
But everybody's better.
Dr. Liu is better now.
And obviously Catherine, so she will be down here at some point. Now class is in session, so it'll be a minute. But
I did not know that she had caught COVID. That's wow.
She got sick. It's insane, man. Everybody's getting it. Well, I made a clip for today, but I didn't put it on YouTube first. I don't know if this is going to be a thing with us or just because I had so many issues with the video essay and getting that up that it just put me behind the eight ball, but I do have a video ready for our show today to get you guys ready for what we're going to talk about. Video didn't play.
I noticed that.
That's strange. Well, it's conspiracy. It is. It's the deep state. That's frustrating.
Cuba's behind it all.
Fucking Cuba is the. You know, he didn't even respond. I put him. You know how he always goes. I thought I was on the show because I was on the email thread. Notice he didn't respond, and he was on the email thread. So he did that. No, that was not a scene from Coachella. Because no one was wearing a flower crown. It's not a dream catcher you see at Coachella. It is flower crowns. I've been to too many Coachellas. And I know that, sadly. Well, let's get our guests in here. Give me 1 second. You've seen him before on the show. He is a professor with... another good friend of show, Teray Reed, Professor Keith Plimers.
Hey guys, thanks for having me back.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for actually helping put this together. Also, shout out to Teray for helping put this together. But once Teray hit Keith up, Keith goes, "You know who would be great at this? A friend of mine, Haley Negrin." So just to let you guys know, Keith Plimers is an expert on modern history and environmental history. He's a professor of history at Illinois State and author. Haley Negrin specializes in Native American history, slavery, and the history of women and gender in the Atlantic world. Her current book project investigates the transformation of indigenous kinship ties and politics under English chattel slavery in early North America. Please welcome Keith and Haley. Sorry, the intro clip didn't play. Maybe I gave myself the wrong one. That's very strange. So I apologize for that. But anyway... let's talk the enslavement of Native Americans. The culture war is heating up in this election year of 2020. And there is so much talk over critical race theory being taught in our primary and high schools, and the 1619 Project, reparations discourse. But there's one thing that seems to be constantly glossed over, and that is Native American enslavement, which happened for quite a long time in the Americas, throughout the Americas. And even, I was kind of shocked to read this, that Native Americans made their way to the African continent in the slave trade as well. What is up with that? Why is this the glossed over, forgotten history? Who wants to take this first?
Why don't I kick it off with a historian one, and then Haley can fill in all the things that I miss. So one of the big problems in doing history just kind of generally is it's tough to write about stuff that people didn't write about at the time. And if you go back to the early modern period, there's a lot of different governments that are going to say it's illegal to enslave Native people. So Spain at one point, there's going to be this very famous debate called the Valladolid debates, which are debating whether or not native peoples had souls, and if they did, they couldn't be enslaved, and if they didn't, they could be. Yeah, brutal stuff. And so you have essentially laws in lots of places that say, we can't enslave these people. And then despite having those laws on the books, places go around and enslave people in large numbers, but they don't sort of write it down and tally things up in the way that feels familiar to scholars who've worked on, say, the enslavement of people of African descent and of Africans. And so there's this sort of record problem where if you're doing history of native slavery in a lot of places, though, as Haley's going to tell you, not every place, it won't be written down in the same way that it has been written down for Africans and people of African descent. So there's this sort of source problem that means to some degree it's hard to find this stuff. And so I think that's one of the like technical things that's behind it. But I'll let Haley take over now.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. That's a good point. The sources are tough to find, though, of course, that is what we said about the African slave trade in what, like the 70s or 80s, right before the African slave trade database, you know, came into being. Like, there was a time when, you know, scholars were like, we'll never know how many people were enslaved in Africa. And now we have pretty damn good numbers. You know, we're never going to know for sure about everybody, but we're doing pretty well. And I think it's my hope that over time, we'll be able to get a little better with numbers for indigenous enslavement in spite of how hard the records are. But another reason I'll just add, there's a lot of reasons. There's so many reasons why this is a little.
What would you say is the main reason? Is it political?
Well, I mean, in the South, you have a situation where older, like the third or fourth generation of Southern slaveholders in South Carolina and Virginia, away from the earlier era of Native enslavement, are going back and saying, I'm going to racialize Native people in a particular way, and I'm going to racialize Black people in a particular way. And they look at, I have this judge from the 1830s in South Carolina who lets a Native person go free. And his whole argument as to why he did that was this discussion of, the Negro, right, is meant to be in a state of enslavement forever. That is where they belong. The Native person is a wild, savage, free person. The red man is meant to be free. So it's this also this very bizarre racialization that's going on that's very specific and changes over time that also has to do with why, especially Southerners, covered it up in the 19th century specifically.
Well, when exactly does this process begin, and how entrenched is it in the historical narrative of the British colonies or the United States exactly? And where was this practice most dominant?
I'm curious what Keith says. I always start with Columbus, right? I mean, I guess prior to him, folks are clearing out the Canaries on the coast of Africa. That's one of the first places where indigenous slavery is going on. I mean, I always say with Columbus, if you're going to acknowledge that he discovered America, you have to say he discovered Indian slavery, because what he was doing in the Caribbean was rampant. He was going on to island after island, just slaving. So that's, it starts with the Spanish, really.
And in terms of British colonies, when the first person, probably Afro-Caribbean, is brought as a slave to Bermuda in 1617, a Native person is brought with him. So there's a way in which African slavery and Native slavery come at more or less the exact same moment in the British Atlantic in particular. If we think about Bermuda as a key site in which slavery is going to start, in which you get early ideas being formed about why people of African descent should be used for labor, what that labor is going to look like. There's African people and Native people who are being brought at the exact same moment. In Barbados, you'll have Native people, a pretty significant number of them. It's 32 are brought in the 1620s. So right about the same time as you're having people of African descent brought there. And yeah, I mean, the two are really just right there at that founding moment together for the British Caribbean, and they function right alongside each other.
Now, we are aware that upon Columbus's arrival, that there is a kind of encapture of the native populations. And according to the narrative, it's with the plea of Las Casas, who basically says that these people are being so brutally, assaulted, murdered, killed, and treated, and that we need to bring, a more robust specimen, and advocating for the Africans. So when we're talking about the phenomenon of native enslavement, are we talking about something that's really limited to the Columbian period of, or we're talking about something that goes well into the 19th century? Because I'm more interested in seeing how it manifests really, particularly in North America.
Mm-hmm. It goes into the 19th
century. And it goes throughout the Americas as well. When we think slavery, I think we also think that it stays particularly in the plantation economy, but we forget about the expansion of the country into the West, where also when you guys talk about the documentation, it's very, very different. And the buy, I was reading about the buying and selling of native people in LA, 1850, yeah. Which was kind of mind blowing. Mm-hmm. So I'll shut up.
Yeah, there's an argument too, to say that kind of residential schools and stealing the life and labor of children, right? Through Native American livelihoods, everything that actually is connected to indigenous slavery, because so many children are also targeted in this practice. So there's an argument that there's a whole big spectrum here of bonded labor and slavery for Native people that connects to pretty much every big moment in Native American history over time, including the residential schools, which is something that people, might know about.
Yeah, and that go into the 20th century for the residential schools. Yeah, the late 20th century. Yeah.
Right,
for
right.
residential schools. But, right. A thing I would say is that, and Jason just brought this up, if we think about the Americas broadly, yeah, we get beyond the plantation because we have to think about things like mining in particular.
Yes, silver.
Spanish colonies. Yeah, silver mines as sort of key right. sites in which Native people are enslaved. And, there's different systems that are going to be in North and South America for what bonded labor looks like. So again, this gets to the sort of source thing I said was tricky. Again, Spanish colonies are going to say, well, you can't enslave any of these people. And then they're going to come up with systems that they will say are not slavery, but in which people are not paid. They're forced to work. They are pretty extreme violence is used against them. And the condition mm-hmm. is bound up in communities as a hereditary form. So they're like, it's not slavery, but it sure sounds a lot like slavery. Well, if you think about it for a second.
That's what was interesting in what I was, and again, I definitely am nowhere near the level of research that, you guys have done in getting ready for the show, but I did definitely have to read up on this. I didn't know much about it. But it seems like from one thing that I did read from Brown University was a study it had more to do with Native populations on the East Coast, but apparently a lot surrendered because they didn't want to be sold to a different country and go overseas. And so they figured, well, if I surrender, maybe the conditions won't be as bad. Mm. Can you guys talk about that as well?
Yeah. So you're referencing there's a project at Brown that the historian Linford Fisher is directing, yes. along with other people, called the Stolen Relations Project.
Yeah.
And that gets at stuff that, I remember first kind of coming across it in the records because after a large war in New England, a number of Native people are sent to Bermuda, and then they're forced to be released by the government of Bermuda. But this is part of this broader pattern in which when English colonists in North America are fighting genocidal wars, the Pequot War in particular, there's one of the most brutal 17th century images you'll ever see of this conflict in which a bunch of it's a woodcut. So the quality of the image to modernize looks kind of crappy, but it's a brutal image because you see just English soldiers surrounding a village full of women and children and just firing into it.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of, you know, despite, you know, we tend to think of like, oh, you know, quality of image in a sort of sense of representing reality, you know, can make them more intense. I mean, this one doesn't have that, but it's a really tough thing to look at. And after that conflict, it wasn't enough for the English to simply like fire on an attempt to kill unarmed people, peaceful people, but then to enslave significant numbers of them, sell them into the Caribbean. And even after you have, you know, you have attempts to sort of free them, there's going to be this consistent pattern through the 17th century of Native people in North America being sold into slavery in the Caribbean. And the same historian, Linford Fisher, points out that when Barbados in the 1670s ultimately tries to outlaw the presence of Native slaves in Barbados, they don't do it for humanitarian purposes. They do it because they're afraid that Native people are violent and rebellious and will encourage enslaved Africans to rise up and kill off the white planters on the island. So like even at the moment of like potential, like a small glimpse where you're like, oh, is that a little brief moment of humanity? No, they're afraid that they won't be able to maintain control on the island here if they have a combination of enslaved Native people and enslaved African people. And like Haley was saying before, it's bound up with these sort of these parallel forms of racialization that are going on in terms of how English people are stereotyping Africans and people of African descent and then Native people.
Well, let's take this super chat here. To what extent was mass enslavement of indigenous peoples limited by the mass deaths of millions of indigenous people from European diseases?
So one thing I would say is that you want to be careful with this idea that disease sort of, you know, made Native people sort of unfit for slavery. I mean, what does it even mean to be a good slave, right? But that is a perception that early colonists actually used to racialize Native people as well, and also to hide Native slavery, to say that, you know, well, we didn't enslave them. They all actually just died of disease. That's actually what it is. And when you actually start to look at the records, and I always tell my students this, yes, disease was a big deal in early Native societies, for sure, when they encountered Europeans. However, if you really start to look at the numbers, you see that a huge amount of African people were also dying at that same moment. And if you look in individual settlements, there are still more Native people than Europeans in those areas. So I think disease has been a cover in a lot of ways, used to kind of hide, both in the time and maybe I think it was a reason scholars didn't look into this as much until, you know, the past 20 years.
Do we have records in terms of what states, particularly in the colonial period or even in the post American Revolutionary period, were most participatory in this process of Native American slavery?
So I would definitely say South Carolina, for sure. That's the mothership of indigenous enslavement in the British colonial world. They enslaved, you know, no, numbers are tough, but, you know, we think around at least 50,000 people, and that's from 1670 to 1717 alone. So they're enslaving a lot of people in South Carolina. And what y'all were talking about earlier about like we have to look off the plantation for Native labor, true, totally true. However, we also kind of have to look on the plantation too, because like there are Native people in those rice fields and in those tobacco fields in Virginia.
So someone asked the question, and I actually read about this, was Native American enslavement generational? Because again, I think, and Keith, you said this, why this show even stuck in my head is when you were on the show the first time, you mentioned this. I forget what the context was, but you mentioned people always estimate how long Native enslavement actually lasted. And so to the question, was indigenous enslavement multigenerational? You two would respond with a...
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, for sure. And in my research, we've got a lot of great work on part of sequitur ventrum and how African women's wombs are targeted, right, to pass on racial slavery to children. And in my research, what I find is like a lot of the same justifications and the same sort of early modern ideas about law and race are being used to do that to Indigenous women too. It just happens in certain areas and at certain times and looks a little bit differently compared to African slavery, depending on how shipments are going and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely happening.
One of the things that I wanted to ask relative to this is that we know that pretty much in 1808, starting with 1807, actually, with legislation, but eventually within the Constitution in 1808, legally, the transatlantic slave trade pretty much is outlawed in terms of North America, largely for reasons having to do with the Haitian Revolution and a few other things, but we don't have to go there. But at the same time, after that, there is a large and rather extensive process, which very few people talk about, of slave breeding, literally, that the slave breeding industry is what helps facilitate the growth of the Black population in America from something around 500,000 in the early 1800s to right before the Civil War, it grows to 4 million. After the importation of Africans stops in North America, was there any type of similar mechanism to increase the native slave population amongst plantation owners or slave owners in North America?
I don't know the answer to that. Haley, do you know the answer to that?
I mean, I haven't. It depends on what you would call a concerted effort or a program. I mean, I have seen in wills, right? I mean, there's a very careful effort to, I'm going to give my daughter a female Indian slave and her increase, right? I'm going to give that to her because that's going to assure not only her, but her children. There's a very concerted effort to match Native women with people who the slave owners are looking to have more slaves, to give them more slaves. And that's kind of happening throughout. But I don't know that I've seen a concerted effort of breeding in the same way that the domestic slave trade was shaped. But, you know, there are also even times where, you know, slave breeding for African people was dialed back too, depending on the nature of the economy. Like in New England in the colonial period, sometimes they're like, actually, I don't want a bunch of people in my small house. I want to slow down the breeding of enslaved Black people. So I guess my point is just that there's a lot of variation over time.
And I think you hit something important there, Haley, too, which is that there's real varieties of where and how enslaved people are held. So we always have to have this tension of like, don't forget that there are, in fact, plantations in Western Virginia and in South Carolina that are dependent on enslaved native labor. But also the idea of people who were enslaved as domestic servants or as sort of domestic labor ends up being a crucial one. A book like Andres Resendez's The Other Slavery is going to point out, you know, some of those sales of enslaved native people in California that Jason referenced from the 19th century, those were bound up with sort of domestic labor. And so there's this way in which even some of the incentives about how what planters will call increase or reproduction, people's children are then bound up with sort of the particular conditions in which people are held and enslaved. And so I think that real sort of variety of conditions and planters and slavers are often, you know, they will sort of think through and slot people into different categories within their labor system. And make all kinds of, you know, frankly, like grotesque determinations about who should be slotted exactly where, and then use those determinations to think through things like, is reproduction good or bad? Do we prefer men or women or children in these particular positions? And so I think that those logics of sort of different categories of slavery or different sort of tasks within a slave economy end up shaping a lot of what happens, what is sort of imposed on individual people and individual circumstances.
Another question I wanted to ask you is that, is there documentation to demonstrate whether or not phenomenon like slave catching, escape slave, runaway slaves, or slave hunting, things of that nature that were more commonplace when it came to the African plantation economy and slave system. Was this something that was also practiced upon Native Americans who were enslaved?
Yeah, I don't know, Keith, if you want to chat.
No, you fire away, Haley.
So in Virginia, there's a couple of early counties that are dependent on indigenous enslavement entirely, almost, for different periods of time. For like 30 years in this one county in Virginia, it's pretty much all indigenous people who are enslaved there. And the reason I just point to that is because what you see is a local development of kind of a mini carceral state in that county that is basically developed to contain indigenous enslaved people. And, you know, like the sheriff, you know, knows the jailer, and the jailer knows, you know, the representative who's going to the house of, you know, the legislature to talk about indigenous enslavement and the law. And they all work together to kind of have a sort of surveillance over indigenous people. There's a lot of attempts to run away that I find in the records from indigenous people. And then there's a lot of catching of them that happens.
Yeah. And I would just flag up what Haley said there, too. You know, this is one of the coolest things about Haley's work, if I could brag about her for a minute here, since she's my friend and whatnot. You know, these geographic distinctions within Virginia for what types of slavery are practiced where is really important if we're going to try to understand the development of early modern markets and the way that, say, commercial development, development of capitalism, things like that are entangled, the degree to which it's entangled with slavery. Well, it's not enough to just say slavery there, because of course, the people who are living in Tidewater, Virginia, and who are the largest planters, you know, if you look at records from the 1620s, they're already starting to have significant numbers of enslaved Africans. But then you're getting a kind of second tier of planters without access to Atlantic slave markets who develop indigenous slavery in those Western counties, which Haley can tell you about, as this sort of they're viewing it almost as an alternative to African slavery, which they can't buy into in the same ways. So there's these parallel systems developing among English colonists in Virginia, and they're trying They're both like, well, coerced labor is really important and we think it's awesome and we should do it. But they develop these really different markets, different systems for how they're going to get enslaved labor. And so, you know, there you have these real distinctions, even geographically within a single colony and then state.
And also class distinctions, too, like you mentioned, Keith, like the planters Keith was just talking about in the Tidewater who adopt African slavery earlier, those folks tend to be the richer ones, right? With indigenous slavery, I think I haven't made this argument yet and had it peer reviewed, but other folks have talked about it, and I think we're right. It's a class situation, and lower class folks tend to be the ones in this period in Virginia who are advocating for access to indigenous slavery because they can't get the Atlantic version.
No, that's interesting. Can you elaborate on that? Is that because the enslavement of Africans was more cost prohibitive and it was cheaper and easier to acquire Native Americans?
Well, so it's actually hard to acquire Native Americans too at this time, but it's because the rich planters in Virginia monopolize the African slave trade. There's like a couple of merchants who are running it in the 17th century and a couple of planters, and they're all working together. And yeah, it is expensive. But indigenous slaves, right, sometimes they can be for, you know, a little bit less money, right? They can be traded, but it completely depends. It's actually more about the economic connections that the planters had with traders of African slaves and how they kind of wanted to keep that to themselves. They didn't want to spread that to the masses. And the lower classes are like, I want slaves. I want them. Fine. I'll go get Indian slaves then if you won't let me have African slaves.
Wow, so they became almost kind of like a secondary market for indigenous slave labor that was not being fulfilled by the presence of Africans.
Yeah, because upper class folks made it impossible for lower class people.
Yeah, and you see this kind of throughout a lot of colonies. It's not just in sort of markets of slavery. That's going to be really important for sort of structuring who owns slaves and then how slave owners structure society into the 19th century, really up to the Civil War in the United States, you know, who is owning and who is not ends up being really important in shaping class distinctions in the U.S. South. But you have, I mean, there's just really different kinds of economic activity that are happening. People are selling in different markets. They're selling different stuff. They're either selling kind of locally or regionally versus in transatlantic markets. And so you have these sort of two interrelated but distinctive economic systems that develop side by side. What's interesting about the Virginia case is that both of them say, like, well, our economic system is going to depend on enslaved labor.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we learn also, and that I really want to get into this, is that there's a presence of indigenous Native Americans on the African continent being used as enslaved labor as well. How exactly does that happen exactly? I mean, I think Jason was talking about that. Or they were imported?
I have no idea on that.
I don't know about this either. I think Jason uncovered something. I don't know.
That was from the Brown. That was from the Brown. Paper. I can't think of the doctor's, the professor's name that wrote that. They were being traded. I'll find it and read the passage.
I mean, I'm not surprised, but he
claims they were being traded throughout the Americas, Bermuda, Spain, and Tangier.
Okay, so North Africa.
Yeah, North Africa.
Interesting.
And he said some actually made it back to the States.
Yeah, I one of the things I think recent scholarship has uncovered that people had not understood before was just how much Native peoples of North America and of South America are moving around and are going different places. You know, we get these little brief moments that I think show up. So in London, there's consistently Indian princes who get brought to London like every few years. And, you know, English people are dumb. They can't figure out social structure. They can't learn other languages. And so they just kind of make stuff up. So they're like, oh, we found a king. We found a prince. We should bring him back to London. And people there are like, wow, it's a king. This is the coolest thing ever. We saw a king. You know, they don't know anybody. But so we get these moments where Native people are moving around the Atlantic. And we know about the really sort of like dramatic ones where they're brought as coerced guests for dignitaries in London and things like that, or to engage in some degree of diplomacy, they hope, or to be in Spain or in France or things like that. But yeah, I think there's a lot more, and we'll find a lot more people on the move the more we look.
Well, I found the part where he says that. So it says, Native American slavery is a piece of history of slavery that has been glossed over, Fisher said, between 1492
and... Oh, no! The good part. He was getting to the good part, but I'm sure that was...
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, you broke out for a little bit.
Yeah, sorry. While natives had been forced into slavery and servitude as early as 1636, it was not until King Philip's War that natives were enslaved in large numbers. Fisher wrote in the study, from the 1675 to 1676 war pitted Native American leader King Philip, also known as Metacom, and his allies against the English colonial settlers. During the war, New England colonies routinely shipped Native Americans as slaves to Barbados, Bermuda, Jamaica, the Azores, Spain, and Tangier in North Africa, Fisher said.
Incredible.
Yeah, that's okay. So now maybe it's starting to click about what that might be. There's this English colony that gets set up in Tangier. I mean, this makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, one of the other things that kind of happens in this period, and it's related to these things, is that across the English world, so the Atlantic and even into the Indian Ocean, slave codes are going to travel. So things that start in Barbados, for example, the language, the rhetoric, specific restrictions on movement, on everything from like ability to have an animal. I mean, they really get that specific. These are just going to sort of ping pong around. So South Carolina codes that are going to sort of define how slavery looks, for example, owe something to ones being cooked up in Barbados as well. And so, yeah, it's not surprising that people are sort of following, because there's laws, there's particular colonial individuals, and yeah, there's enslaved people who are moving all around. So yeah, that makes total sense why Tangier is in there now, because that's at this moment when there's this English project there, and they're thinking that they are gonna have maybe another colonial outpost this time in North Africa. Things don't go great there, but that's another story.
Yeah. The English Empire is global and it is vast, though we only talk about the North American mainland often, right? When we're talking about American history, it's vast.
No, absolutely. But I mean, I know that we were talking about the difficulty in ascertaining numbers here, but I mean, not to make your jobs harder than it already is, but can you give us a sense in terms of at least some context what we're talking about in terms of various periods of time? What's the overall quotient of these indigenous folk that are being enslaved?
So Andres Resendez estimates that between 1492 and 1900, which note that end date that he's going to get to, there are between 2.5 and 5 million native peoples who are enslaved throughout the Americas, so North and South America combined, which is a substantial number. That's a really huge number across the Americas.
Do we have any more specific and detailed numbers for North America in and of itself?
I don't think anybody's tried to put that together, just North America. Have you seen that, Keith? I haven't. I'll see some in the South. I'll see some for, you know, different areas, but.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. But I mean, I think you could point to, what was the number you gave for how many people in Virginia, South Carolina in the 17th and 18th centuries? Because I think that gives a sense of the scale that this is not just sort of small. I mean, the first things you encounter are like, one or two people early in the 17th century, but by the time Haley's working, you get really significant numbers.
Yeah, so in South Carolina, and one of the things too about the time period, so in South Carolina between like 1670 and 1717, this is a time of the maturation of the plantation complex there. Like they are figured out at this time, you know, how to be profitable, right, through rice, and also African slavery and indigenous slavery is how they're going to make their money. So they're literally figuring everything out. And in that time period, while they're working on that, 50,000 indigenous people are enslaved from 1670 to 1717. So I find it pretty significant that the same moment they're trying to figure out African racial slavery and rice and how to make the plantation machine profitable, they are enslaving massive numbers of indigenous people as well. And yet we don't really talk about that as much.
Okay. Another question I wanted to ask you, and this is something that actually Keith, you had brought up last time you were on our show, was that one of the interesting things about the way in which the plantation economy worked overall, including North America, is that the labor specificity of the Africans that were imported was something that's rarely discussed, in that there were Africans from certain geographical locations on the African continent. For example, we talk about often Senegambia in terms of being the rice coast and their capacity to know how to grow rice, and how various Africans from different regional locations on the continent were imported because of the skill sets they had obtained in their locality, in their, you know, indigenous homeland. Was there any similar type of process with indigenous Native Americans that we have record of, in which they may have had particular skill sets in their localities that were incorporated into the indigenous slave plantation system.
Keisha, I share thoughts first.
Yeah, why don't you go first? Because you've got a lot of stuff after it's more mature, and I just have the sort of opening moments in which this thing kicks off.
Well, so I have evidence in Virginia of planters targeting indigenous young men and boys for particular hunting expeditions that they're going on. They're always trying to get rid of wolves because they're coming after their cattle. So that's one thing that we do know is a legit skill transfer. It's really hard to prove all this stuff, and it's scholars get into really tough debates even about rice culture and the knowledge that West African women had or didn't have when they came to South Carolina. So there's a lot of debate about that even on the African side, but in the indigenous context, I think for me, what I have found to be pretty clear, they care about hunting skills, and then they also care about the ability to plant corn. So Indian corn becomes a really important part of the plantation complex because it's a food source in South Carolina and Virginia. And who would be an expert in quote Indian corn but Native American women, right, who were enslaved all throughout the South. So corn is a big one. And then, you know, there might be some pullover with tobacco. It's possible, but I would say corn and hunting would be the main thing I would point out. What do you think, Keith?
So it's when I look at like Bermuda and Barbados earlier in the 17th century, at Native people are brought there for agricultural expertise for a number of the same reason that some of the first enslaved African people are brought. And it comes down to, you know, particular crops. So if you think about something like manioc, for example, which is a tuber, if you don't know what you're doing with manioc and you eat it, you'll poison yourself. And English people poison themselves with staggering frequency. They're really, really, you know, they just keep eating it. They get sick. They don't. But so even just growing plants, you'll have English people pretty consistently say things like, we need someone who knows how to grow stuff here. We need someone who knows what to do with these things. We need someone who knows that. And so in particular, you know, when you're looking kind of at the earliest moments of slavery in the English Atlantic, in many cases, they're saying, well, you know, hopefully Native people figure out how to do this. And sometimes they will sort of make Native people and African people interchangeable in their heads. In Bermuda and Barbados, because in Barbados, the Native population that had been there historically was not there at the moment when English people grabbed the island. English people essentially needed to invent Natives to teach them how to do stuff. And so they both stole Native people from the continent, from South America, Circum-Caribbean region, but then also brought in enslaved African people, many of whom had likely been enslaved in the Spanish Caribbean, with the idea that, you know, somehow between these groups you would get a sort of local expert who could teach them how to do stuff that they couldn't figure out on their own. So yeah, there's a way in which agricultural knowledge ends up being really important. And interestingly, regarding hunting, one of the few images we have of an enslaved Native person from Barbados in the 17th century is on this map of the island produced in the 1650s, and he's there with a bow and a lot of animals. And so yeah, there is this sense in which like hunting skill, fishing skill, it's something that English people can't figure out, and so they look for someone else who will teach them how to do it.
We had a really good question that showed up on the screen about the cooperation between escaped or escaping Africans going on to Native American tribal lands, reservations, I guess would be the proper term, because they wouldn't have been reservations at that time. But is there evidence of any kind of cooperative effort? I know we have the story of in Florida with the rebellion between the Native Americans and the African slave enslaved against the Andrew Jackson administration. I don't know why the name of that actual rebellion is escaping me at the moment. It's a very Florida history. I live in Florida, as a matter of fact. But are there other examples of enslaved Africans engaging with either enslaved Native indigenous populations or working with them to fight against the plantation economy or escape into their tribal lands or tribal territories? Please share.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely examples of that happening in Virginia. There's also, there's one case I follow where it's a mixed Afro-Indigenous family that is escaping together in the 1730s. And they go from South Carolina and they make their way to New Jersey. They come from New Jersey to back to South Carolina because they have indigenous kin in that region. So I see that. I also see instances where there are reasons why Native nations can't cooperate with runaway African people. That also happens as well. So it kind of depends on the time period and sort of what's going on with the relationship between the state and Native people in a given area. But I do see cooperation.
Yeah, in the Caribbean, there's quite a bit of it as well. So in Dominica, for example, you have pretty significant, it's a place that's an important site of marinage from Barbados in particular, where in many cases, unlike Jamaica, say, where you have large maroon communities that live in mountains and burn plantations, things like that. In Barbados, sort of on the island, marinage is a little bit tougher. People do it, but in many cases, they do what the historian Hilary Beckles calls maritime marinage. So they get in vessels of their own making and go elsewhere, which is terrifying, right? You don't know where you're going, but you're elsewhere. And in that case, the Kalinago of the Caribbean, people who are sometimes called Black Caribs in cases, you have these mixed African and indigenous communities that develop around the Caribbean into the 18th century. So they persist for a long time on sort of outlying islands that aren't at the hub of the British plantation complex there. You have these moments where there's communities that develop together, where people are adopted into communities, and that are very much bound up with things like marinage and escaping slavery.
Well, one of the things that we're going to want to touch on, because we're coming up close to the end of the hour, is, and this is a hot topic that is always brought up, particularly in the issue of reparations and whatnot, is the role of Native Americans in the enslavement of Africans or Black people in North America. And I'd love to actually discuss the extent to which this occurs or does not occur, and why exactly it's something that is really, I find it as a means to delegitimize, number one, any kind of notion of solidarity between the two communities. It's oftentimes brought up, and often as a kind of upsmanship in terms of reparations discourse, is like they enslaved us too, so they don't deserve to get anything, or so on and so forth. So I'm really interested in understanding, like, what are the politics that surround this particular phenomenon, the extensive nature of it, and what that's about.
Because you're talking about the civilized tribes, Pascal. Was it the five civilized tribes?
Five civilized tribes, yeah.
So I'm sure Keith has plenty to say about this as well. But I guess I'll just start by saying that in the early 1800s, Cherokees owned 600 enslaved African people. There's about like 20 to 35 families in Cherokee Nation. That's it, that own enslaved African people. And I think that the question for scholars has been, how do you frame this right? How do you capture the violence, right, of being a slave owner, right, which is violence no matter how many people you're enslaving, no matter what you're doing, but also how do you capture the layers of violence that are being, that Native people are experiencing in this time period? So Taya Miles wrote a book called The House on Diamond Hill that I think does this perfectly, where she talks about how, colonialism is actually a major reason why Cherokees turned to slaveholding and cotton growing in the South, right? Because the argument coming from Jackson and everybody else, right, is you're not civilized enough to keep your land. You're not civilized enough and you're not white enough to be sovereign. And so the response from, you know, well-to-do Cherokees is like, well, okay, I'll civilize myself. And part of that is becoming a slave owner. You know, that doesn't allow them to keep their land though in the end, right? Because in the end, in America, right, you have to be white to be sovereign, really, I think is what removal teaches us.
And is that what they're trying to do though? Are they trying to assimilate, if you will, by slave owner support? Supporting the Confederacy in some instances.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you can see this in the South throughout time. I mean, Native people will generally side with whatever side will, you know, offer them the ability to keep their land. You know, whatever side, you know, during the Revolution, you see this, during the American Civil War, you see this. You kind of have to get rid of like the general sort of dichotomies we can see, North and South, slave and free, or patriots and loyalists. Like you have to get more into localized indigenous politics to understand why, for instance, one of the nations I study, the Catawbas, you know, joined the Confederacy, right, and not the Union, even though the Confederacy is clearly a state built on racial patriarchy. So I guess that's just to say that, you know, I think that in our minds, Native slave ownership of Black people looms so much larger than what it actually maybe was. And as I say that, you have to be really careful because you don't want to minimize the violence, right, of this experience. But I will say numbers-wise, you can pretty much point to that. I don't know, Keith, do you have anything to add?
No, I mean, I think, you know, Jason brought up one of the key points, which is that for the U.S. state that develops, participating in certain types of property relations are a way to designate yourself as a legitimate part of the political community.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at sort of the broad history of Native peoples of North America and their interaction with Europeans, their consistent attempts to figure out how to navigate European systems of sort of sovereignty, of things like that, and to keep.
Did Keith break up?
I think you froze for a second there. Froze a little bit.
Jeez. Is Keith in Mexico as well?
I don't think Keith is in Mexico. He's in Illinois, which is close enough.
The exotic state of Illinois.
Keith, you didn't tell me you had Baja internet in Illinois.
Apparently Central Illinois is dealing with a similar quality of internet as Baja.
Greatest comment. Hold on, this is moving too fast. But someone said, Gigi said 1619 project got him. Not even the deep state. It was Nicole Hannah Jones. She was like, nope. You shall not pass. It's Nicole Hannah Jones at it again.
You know, standing outside tonight in these temperatures, cutting my crappy internet is a punishment in and of itself, honestly.
Well, before you answer that, don't even answer the question. Save your answer because we are coming up on the end of the hour. And I know it's later where you guys are, so I want to make sure that I steal both of you for the bonus patron-only champagne room. We now call it the champagne room.
I like that. That's fancy.
Thank you, Chris Catrone, for helping us out with that name. I forget why we even wanted to call it when that show happened. But we're going to dive deeper into this question of Native Americans enslaving Africans, Native Americans working with freed African slaves, and then Keith promises in the champagne room he will discuss his choice for who gets reparations.
Oh, God.
He said like an award off air. He's like, it's like an award. And you choose. It's a tiered system of choice.
Oh, boy.
And he said he could only do it behind a paywall because, you know, he likes his job.
trying to kill me.
I'm totally kidding about the last part, but the other parts, I'm being totally serious. So thank you, guys. I will be sending you a link to the champagne room. If you're already a patron, you should already have the link. If you want to get in on this discussion, bam, link is on the screen, patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. Pascal, are you ready?
Ready to rock and roll.
All right. And we are out.
Refrigerator's broke. Fuck.